but it gradually moved into what I think of as bigger mysteries. What your memories are when you're old, how you review your life, these sort of unanswerable mysteries.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Deirdre, or Dee, McNamer, whose novel Aviary is one that takes place in an unnamed mountain town not unlike the author's home of Missoula, Montana. Deirdre McNamer is the author of 5 novels, Aviary, Remen the Weeds, One Sweet Coral, My Russian, and Red Rover, which was a winner of the Montana Book Award. Dee, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren. It's nice to be here.
If you could estimate maybe how long did it take you to write Aviary from the point at which you conceptualized the narrative to, you know, hardcover in hand? How long has it been?
Well, my last novel, Red Rover, was published in 2007. Now, I'm telling this, giving you the exact timeline, not as a way of discouraging writers out there, because it's a very long one, but just to show what different phases putting together a book can go through. After I published that book, I worked for 3 years on another novel that finally was not going where I wanted it to go. Certain aspects of it did transfer to Aviary, but not many, and I ultimately abandoned it. And after that, I was, for the next 5 or 6 years, I was pretty intensely involved in caring for my parents who lived here in Missoula in an apartment building for senior citizens. And they were both having health problems. Their health was declining. And it was a lot of almost daily visits to where they lived and taking care of them and being with them. And so I was writing this in little spurts, and I was in some ways trying to shield myself, I think, from what was going on in the family. And I tried to make it very funny in the first version that I saw through to an end. It was a funny mystery is how I thought of it, but it was finally too flippant. And I realized that I was writing that way to shield myself, I think, from having to look straight on at where we all were and what was happening with my parents. So I reviewed it, I thought about it, and I continued the mystery, but I took more time getting to know the characters so that I had to take them in a more serious sort of way, and hopefully a reader ultimately would. And then the literal mystery of the book, a fire is set in an old person's building and a detective investigates whether it's arson and why someone would have wanted to set it. That stayed, but it gradually moved into what I think of as bigger mysteries, mysteries of what your memories are when you're old, how you review your life, what chances you took or didn't take in the course of your life. These sort of unanswerable mysteries began to interest me more. And so the book, I think, eventually fanned out into that realm so that it didn't end up being strictly a conventional crime mystery. And all of that, writing it in so many different moods and over in so many different circumstances, took up the better part of the next, you know, I finally finished it in 2019 and sold it in 2019. And then there was some going back and forth, some last changes and so on. So that's my long answer to a succinct question. And the succinct answer would be, it took me a very long time.
the relationships that one is to read in Aviary, are those relationships and, you know, these characters, are these characters that you witnessed in the apartment building that your parents lived in? Were these, you know, direct influences? Or obviously you're a novelist, you're a fiction writer, so I'm sure you took certain liberties. But I was really moved by the way you wrote about aging people, because I think that they are often forgotten about. They are, you know, kind of shoved to the side. They are put in these communities and not given a lot of respect. And I really, really, yeah, I was very moved by the way that you wrote about them.
Well, thank you. In all of my work, all the fiction I've written, I tend not to transfer qualities directly from people that I know. What will happen instead is that I will perhaps have a glancing exchange with a person or come to know them a little bit, and then they function as instigations to an act of pure imagination. So in that building, for example, where my parents were, yes, I did meet some other residents in the elevator, and, you know, they were friends with several different people there, but I didn't know them well at all. And I didn't come to know them well at all. But what I did do was try to imagine, use the person as a sort of trigger, I guess is the word, to try to imagine what their life might have been. And in fiction, I think all that matters is that you make it convincing. And that takes time as well. And so I'll use that excuse for taking so long to write this. But I think that you have to immerse yourself in your created characters for a good amount of time before they come off the page as real, interesting, layered people. So no, these are not, the characters in this book are not based directly on information I had about real people in the real world, but certain people triggered my wish to imagine a kind of a person, and the result didn't bear any very much resemblance at all to the circumstances of the triggering person, if that makes any sense. But it's peculiar. Writing fiction is so arrogant and strange in so many ways, because you're making it up, you're labeling it as something that's made up, and yet you're being audacious enough to try to make these made up people seem very, very real to a reader, or else I feel you haven't really succeeded. So it's a strange process, and it sometimes amazes me that people read fiction at all, because it's labeled as made up. And yet we seem to, as humans, want to leap into lives that people have imagined for us. And I've always been that way. I've always been a reader. Any serious, you know, or intense reader lives a lot in made up regions.
Well, let's talk about this unnamed city that you've set Aviary in. It takes place in a city that's a lot like Missoula, Montana. It's a university town. There's a quote-unquote university district. It lives at the bed of a glacial lake. You see Go Grizz banners on balconies and windows. It's a river town. There are so many parallels between this unnamed town in your book and Missoula, Montana. And I'm always curious about those parallels and how they're addressed in fiction specifically. And perhaps Aviary, the book itself, is the answer to this question. But why not name the town you're writing about? Why not call the town where it seems to be, Missoula?
My reason is that I wanted this book to be threaded with a sense of a sort of otherworldliness that, if you've ever seen Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, you know, there's a big old hotel set up on a mountainside, and it looks like a fairyland hotel almost. It's very stylized. It's very dreamy. and it has this ensemble cast of characters, one of them in the movie, one of them remembering when he was a bellboy, I think, in the hotel in its heyday. And I don't like to use the word that much, but I wanted a tinge of sort of magic about this town, this setting. And I felt that if I labeled it, if I was explicit about it, then anyone who knew anything about Missoula or had their own versions of Missoula or had passed through Missoula or saw it on a map, it would limit their imaginations in some way to know that this was the actual Missoula. I want all the readers of this book to be able to imagine themselves in the world that I created in this book. And if they have a different explicit version of where this place is and what the town is like, I didn't want it to clash with mine. And so I feel like it was more to give it a sense of a little ghostliness, just a tinge of ghostliness to the whole town. And there are aspects of it. I mean, you mentioned the glacial lake, you know. I mean, there's a really sort of, that's an uncanny kind of edge to a little city in the mountains, is that you're sitting at the bottom of what was just this stupendous glacial era, you know, epochs ago, a huge lake that repeatedly drained and filled again. And you can look up on the hills, around the low mountains around Missoula, and see the water lines to this day. And I just think that that's kind of dreamy and strange. And I wanted that quality to be attached to this place. And I felt it was more likely to seem a little uncanny if I didn't give it a name.
I love the word you used. I think you said ghostly. I think that is a really good descriptor for Aviary. There are so many different kinds of ghosts and almost hauntings in this book. So I think that's a really good descriptor. Before we get too much further into talking about specifics, would you mind reading an excerpt from the book?
No, not at all. Maybe the easiest one is, I'll just read right from the very beginning, because it has a little bit, I think, I hope, that of that tone. It's the very, very edge of the day, which is one of my favorite times. It's just when the daylit world isn't quite here yet. And it tells you a little bit about this town that goes nameless. While they slept, the sun lifted itself above the mountains surround to spread light on the little city below. Inside that city, urban deer glided across frozen November lawns to return to their hollows under backyard pines. Feline huntresses licked the blood off their paws and went home for kibbles and stomach rubs. A tied-up, shivering dog made three tight circles in the dirt and began to bark. Two joggers with lights on their shoes panted grimly and stepped up their pace. An old falcon moved slowly, ejecting rolled newspapers onto front steps. And then a roseate calm prevailed, and the mountains moved in closer. While they slept, in their boxes inside the bigger box of their four-story building, street sounds began, the buses, the early workers. The river moved with low water deliberation through the center of town, carrying oblong shards of ice beneath one bridge and then another. A muttering man with crazy hair dragged a lumpy sleeping bag from a stand of tall bushes and resettled himself beneath the second bridge, up under the trusses, a few yards from the coffee place on the ground floor of the new bank. They slept not far from the river in a neighborhood thickly planted with maples and tall old homes, in a 24-unit residence for seniors called Pheasant Run. In a normal autumn, the maples put on showy displays, fanning high into the sky, then shattering into slow red waterfalls until the branches were lattices, not crowns, and the sky was twice as large. This year, the leaves have refused to drop, They have clung ash-colored to the branches, inspiring general unease and several letters to the newspaper, which invited a certified arborist to weigh in. He explained that the normal separation process between leaf and twig produces a membrane that seals off the leaf and enables it to fall. Extreme cold at the wrong time, like the shocking sub-zero stretch of days that happened in October, can derail that process, he said. The tree basically clutches and the leaves stay attached. They were strange, those gray leaves, abiding in the wrong place at the wrong time. They turned the trees to sepia-toned photographs, or remembered trees, or witnesses to some sapless aftermath. They slept at Pheasant Run, and then they woke and prepared to move into a day with nothing yet about it to suggest the small and large shocks to come.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Deirdre, or Dee, McNamer, author of Aviary. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You know, this introduction is really interesting because you actually are speaking very little about the human tenants of this building or even the human residents of this unnamed town. For the most part, you're speaking to the natural, these trees that just are clutching to their leaves, and the animals that are kind of around before everyone rises for the day. Mm-hmm. In a chapter titled When Being Human is Far From Enough, you do introduce a couple, a human couple, an animal communicator, Rhonda, and then the city's fire inspector, Lander Mackey. Am I saying Mackey correctly?
Yes, Mackey.
And the two have a number of pets. They're, you know, a dog couple. They've got dogs and birds and a turtle. But what I'm wondering, especially in relationship to this title of the chapter, Dee, when do you find that being human is far from enough?
Well, as you point out, this book is just full of animals. And I hadn't really realized it until a friend pointed it out to me, a good reader, writer friend, and he said, why are there all these animals in this book? And it made me think that when you're old, my dad had a sister who was beginning to lose her memory. She was older than he, and he liked to say that she was a little out of this world. He didn't say out of it. He would say out of this world. And so it had that connotation of affection as well, you know, as being somewhere else. And I think that all the animals are around and within and without. Because when you move to the edges of the daylit human world, that's the realm of animals. And they are uncanny in many ways. Animals are so strange when you think about it, that and their powers are so superhuman, some of them, powers of navigation with birds and fish especially, and superhuman smelling in dogs, and just that whole sort of humming, buzzing world that is not human is the kind of realm I think that very old people are moving into, not necessarily literal animals, but being on the edges of human life and seeing things there that aren't strictly ordinary in human terms. And then the animal communicator part that comes in. Yes, I think we both have know people who have used animal communicators. It's not a profession that I made up by any means. There are a number of pretty widespread existence of people who try to establish communication with animals, sometimes via just looking at a photo of the animal and then, you know, extending their powers of telepathy or intuition or whatever to make contact with the animal and in some cases alter the animal's behavior. If they're misbehaving or have bad habits, sometimes their owners will put them in touch with an animal communicator, hoping that this will fix things. I think there is a way in which humans are not enough, that being human is not enough. There's plenty to learn from the animal realm. I mean, I don't want to discount animal communicators, but it seems to me a little insulting to the animal to put their problems into human terms. You know, it gets very anthropomorphized. And the reasons for their behavior being translated into the reasons a human might behave in a certain sort of way seems to me a little reductionist. But that said, I do think that people who are engaged in that sort of profession really do have a highly developed sense of empathy, at the very least, with animals, and an appreciation of that realm as being an important one and on the edges of what we tend to, as humans, consider centrally important. There's a lot of strands to that sort of complicated question and complicated answer, but I guess it's just also a subject I like to think about, is the role of other living things in our lives.
I loved your complicated answer. I felt like there was so much there between, you know, living on the edges of things. I felt like that was a beautiful way to put it. But this idea of empathy is maybe where I want to go next, because it is so present in the novel. There's a pheasant run tenant named Viola Six. And throughout the novel, no one really takes her seriously. She tells a lot of stories. She has a lot of theories about what's going on in the apartment building. But there is a point in the novel where she even questions her son's belief in her. And you write, she wondered if he believed her, whether he'd care much at all about what she experienced. For the first time in many years, her answer to that question felt like grief. And so my question to you, Dee, about empathy specifically and its relationship to grief, are those things that cause you grief, this idea of empathy and age? And what does your grief feel like? What does it look like?
Well, I think that in the moment that you speak of in the book, when she is, she's had an estranged, somewhat estranged relationship with her son, and he's not of much help to her, and he doesn't seem to care very much about her. And she's managed to be quite sort of matter of fact about it until this moment when she's been gone through some trouble, she's feeling fragile, and once again, he seems not to be available. And I think that that is a central kind of grief for maybe a lot of us, is when you want to have a connection with someone and it doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen in the way that you would like it to. It's this continual human problem of trying to get outside our own borders and understand someone else and be understood by someone else or other people. And it just never goes away. It seems that it's such a strong impulse on the part of so many people, and such a frustrating one in some, at least at some times and with some people in some circumstances. So I think that that is a shared grief that a lot of us have, of not being understood, of having our borders sealed off in a way, not permeable enough to other people. But you asked what my kinds of grief were, and I think they do have to do, most of them, finally, with an absence of empathy in one way or another. It grieves me to think of, say, an old person who has been left alone, essentially, for some years, to be on a ventilator and dying alone of COVID. You know, I mean, just that just seems sort of beyond grief in some ways, with no one there to convince them that they're understood and appreciated. In the grief realm, generally it's an absence of a sense that the people who are controlling your life or are important in your life don't seem to be able to want to go beyond their own borders of self-interest to find someone, you know, to make a connection with someone else, whether it's an individual or whether it's people in power who seem to just be quite willing to relegate certain classes of people or kinds of people or to the edges of what matters.
Dee, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I think temperamentally, I'm a short-term optimist and a long-term pessimist. You know, the very worst happening on a grand scale wouldn't actually surprise me, but I tend to be able to feel optimistic in the short term, you know, and I'm not necessarily fatally optimistic in the long term, but I'm not counting on everything panning out wonderfully, you know, because it never does happen to most humans. And we're just going to go through lots of different stages and experiences and so on. But my mother, when she was quite old and having serious health problems, she had what I like to call her joy gene. You know, things could be very bad, and she managed, not in a silly way, but just she had some little store of resilience that made her able to appreciate small things and beautiful things and moments and people that were not grand and large experiences, but she seemed to be able to take joy in life, even when it wasn't being very good to her in terms of her, you know, circumstances and her body and her health. So I like to think that maybe I just genetically got a little hit of that, I hope.
Where is the optimism in Aviary?
I think it's a book that might suggest that it's a mistake to ever consider yourself to be living in your last chapter of life. I mean, things can just turn on a dime for the better, even when you think that they might not or that it's too late. And I've known people who have, in the last stages of their life, have made new relationships, new important relationships, or have, you know, discovered some the answer to some question that was bugging them their whole life, or just had a surprise, you know, something surprising and good has happened in their life. And so I like to think that part of what it's about is that you're never beyond second chances at, you know, some new and kind of interesting development.
Dee, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Lauren. The Right Question is one of my very favorite listening experiences, and you do a wonderful job, and I'm proud to have been asked to be part of it.
Look for more information about Dee at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag, and me, I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Austin. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.